I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9.04 a.m. on Thursday, April 6th, 2017. Present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Tilton, Grin, Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. And at this meeting, we will hear HB 114, which is the boiler pressure vessel inspection reports, and then HB 121, which is the occupational health and safety civil penalties, and HB 120, which is the Department of Law advocacy before FERC. And so it's my intention to have all three of these bills heard today. And if it is the will of the committee, I plan to report out to all three bills today. And so our first bill is HB 114, which is the Boiler Pressure Vessel Inspection Reports. And here to present on that is sponsor Representative Sam Keto and his aide Bianca Carpinetti. And so with that, if both of you could come to the table and put yourselves on the record and go ahead and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Sam Keto, Representative, House District 33, Northern Southeast Alaska, including downtown Juneau, Douglas Island, Skagway, Haines, Clequan, Gustavus, and Excursion Inlet. It is a pleasure to be here before House Finance today, and before you, you have House Bill 114. It is the first bill of ours that is moving or being discussed in this committee. What we have is a proposed changes to the boiler and pressure vessel inspection reports program, and the situation has arisen where there are a limited number, but a fair number of inspection reports that are being submitted manually, and the department is required to take that information and re-enter into a database. And so the goal of the department is to take those manual reports, recover cost at $10 a report that has to be filed, but there is an electronic filing option, and that electronic filing option would not have that $10 additional fee, so that if all of the reports are filed electronically, there would be no additional revenue, but there would be less expense for the department because they're no longer having to manually enter all of those reports in. So it's a matter of trying to move the last of the companies into the 21st century for reporting. It also decreases the amount of time available to turn the report around, and that is a recognition of the fact that we do have the ability to move things electronically and get reports filed timely so that the owners can receive their inspection certificate more timely, so they don't have to wait a full 30 days for those inspection reports. So kind of a little bit of a cleanup, but also trying to move the inspection report process into the electronic age. So with that, the department is here to provide additional information, answer specific questions, and we are also available to answer questions.
Thank you. And as has been mentioned, Deborah Kelly, Director of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, is available here in the room, it appears, for questions, if there are questions. So with that, we've got a question from Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just curious. There's actually 3,200 reports not filed electronically. Yeah, there's actually 3,200 people, different ones that do it manually. I can't believe that.
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, those are 3,200 individual boiler and pressure vessel reports. They've actually, at this point, are filed by an individual company that doesn't use electronic program.
A lot. Thank you.
Questions of the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you heard back? Is there any reason somebody can't do it because of broadband, or is it just really changing habits?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, my understanding is a change of habits, but I'd have to defer to the department for a more detailed answer.
If you could put your name on the record.
For the record, this is Deborah Kelly, Director of Labor Standards and Safety for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki.
Wilson.
Apologize.
They get mixed up all the time.
As far as the question about whether folks are, the question was whether we're moving them into as far as
whether the broadband or other limitations are keeping them from filing electronically.
So the reason that these 3,200 or so reports per year are not filed electronically is generally due to the fact that one or two companies don't want to use that jurisdiction online system. It is a software that they do have to pay a fee to use, and one company nationwide has decided they would rather not use that and would rather rely on us for their data entry.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
And how, what is the cost of that system?
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety, Representative Wilson. We tried to find out that cost, but it's one of those systems where the company has to negotiate with the manufacturer based on company size, and we were unable to get an estimate.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So you couldn't go to a company that's already doing it to at least find out what they're paying to? I mean, I don't know how big of a company, is it, you know, whether we're just talking about one or two companies of a size that no one else is, but, you know, if we're going to be putting this on the businesses, it would be, I'd at least like to know what kind of burden we are putting on them.
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety, Representative Wilson. We were not able to find that information, which is why we went with a very reasonable by-cost fee for our data entry. We are willing to do that on those companies' behalf.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Representative Kito, there's no problem that I see for companies that don't want to do it electronically. Your bill gives them the option, correct? So you can continue the way you are for $10, or you can save the $10 and not buy the computer, or you can do either. You can do it either way, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes. So there is an option for a company that continues to not want to use the electronic monitoring program. The department is just trying to acknowledge that they do have a cost associated with entering that data.
Any further questions? I also want to note that we were joined earlier by Co-Chair Seaton and Representative Guttenberg, and seeing no further questions, we will go to public testimony. Do we have anyone online? We have nobody online. Is there anybody in the room? Seeing nobody in the room, we will close public testimony. And for those who may want to submit public testimony, they can also do so by submitting written testimony to housefinance@akleg.gov. No spaces for housefinance@akleg.gov. So with that, see, Representative Guerra has stepped out. We just need somebody to read the fiscal note into the record. Representative Seaton. If you could read the fiscal notes.
HB114 has a zero fiscal note with an additional $32,000 for a year in revenue to the building safety account. Department of Labor and Workforce Development appropriated labor standard safety allocation mechanical inspection 1B component number 346.
Okay, thank you, Representative Seaton. And if it is the will of the committee, Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to put on the record, although it shows the $32,000 going in, that's only if people choose not to do it electronically. Otherwise, this could be a zero fiscal note on both sides if they decide to go electronically instead, which I think is still the desire of the department, because I'm not too sure the $10 would cover the entire fee.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. If there are no further comments, and if it is the will of the committee, Representative Seaton, if I could have a motion to move HB 14, which is version D for Delta, from the House Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would move
House Bill 114 LS, or 30 LS 0361 / D, in committee with zero fiscal note and individual recommendation.
Any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 114 version D is reported out from House Finance Committee. And with that, let's take a quick at ease to sign the report. Okay, our next bill is HB 121, which is the Occupational Health and Safety Civil Penalties. And here to introduce the bill is the sponsor, Representative Sam Keto, and his aide, Bianca Carpinetti. And so, if Representative Keto, if you could present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And for the record, my name is Sam Keto, Representative House District 33, Northern Southeast Alaska, including downtown Juneau. Before you, you have House Bill 121. These are changes to our Alaska Occupational Safety and Health regulations to comply with federal law. Federal law recently, fairly recently, increased the minimum penalties that need to be assessed, and because we are a designated jurisdiction, which means that we have our own responsibility for our occupational and safety and health program, we need to update our program in order to comply with federal law. And this bill does that, but it does that slightly differently than normal, which what it does is allow the department to continue to adopt regulations as federal law changes to make sure we're meeting the minimum standard. And one of the questions in a former committee was, with the increase in standard, are we actually increasing the burden on companies? The answer to my satisfaction was that we don't, so that we do have penalty requirements right now, and the department can fill in the gaps. But when the penalties are assessed, generally the state of Alaska assesses about 10% of the allowable penalty, but we do need to have those minimum standards. So without those minimum standards and without compliance with federal law, we do in the state of Alaska run the risk of losing our designation for the jurisdiction, and the program could go back to the federal government. But going back to the federal government means, in my understanding, two things. One, that state of Alaska employees will no longer be covered under workers' compensation, and then two, that the Alaska program has some specific Alaska components for occupational safety and health, and we would lose those by going to the federal program. And with that, I can answer questions, or we can have the department provide either a brief presentation or answer questions as well.
Okay, are there any questions for Representative Keto, Ms. Bianca Carpinetti, or Ms. Deborah Kelly, Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So The issue I had with the bill is there was a question and answer sheet, and it wasn't in our packet. I saw it in the material. But one of the questions that was asked in judiciary that was responded to in writing was how much would the state save if Alaska's occupational safety and health jurisdiction was returned to federal OSHA? And it says that we would save $619,000. However, penalty revenue would go to the federal treasury instead of the state general fund, totaling $1,031,000. This would result in a net loss to the state of $412,000. I am all in favor in keeping a program Alaskan. I'm very concerned when we're keeping the program because we can collect the penalties on our businesses. So that's, and I do appreciate the email we got last night with more explanation, but this is, so somebody could just, are we having a lot of issues, you know, and people, you know, breaking the laws, or where does this $412,000 come from? Or the, it's actually $1 million.
For the record, this is Deborah Kelly, Director of Labor Standards and Safety for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. The answer to your question is that the, if you look at the fiscal note, that kind of answers where the, gives a little bit more background information. Right now, we collect approximately, I'll just use general numbers, 600,000 in penalties per fiscal year. And with the approximately 78% increase, we estimate that that will increase by about 400,000. You'll see 435, that's the exact number, per year in addition. So the total there is that $1 million in penalties that you see. And quite frankly, those penalties are not optional. It's either we collect them or eventually the federal takeover will come in and collect those for the federal government. So that $1 million is the total penalty amount. The 619 is the savings in state funds from the elimination of the positions and the travel and other associated costs for our ACOSH enforcement program. So when you subtract the savings from the loss of that penalty amount, that's where you get the $412,000. And well, if you'd like, I can address the issue of the collecting penalties on our businesses. Quite frankly, most businesses try to do the right thing, and we do a lot of inspections every year. We are out there in the community, across industries, seeing businesses every single day. And a lot of times, when we find violations, those penalties are reduced, sometimes even down to zero, based on small business size or good faith efforts on the part of the company. So I would say that no, we are not generally seeing a lot of violations, and that's why we collect less than 10% of the maximum allowable penalties in the course of a year.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Oh.
I guess I've just never seen where you, I mean, I don't know whether this is an average, you know, how you came up with the 596,000, because that's, you know, before the increase on it, but I would hope things would, you know, we're getting better because you're doing more education and you're working with businesses. So if you could just address, so this 596, is this just what happened last year? So you use this one? Is it an average number? Or do we normally collect that much every year? As
through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety, Representative Wilson. That's correct. This $596,000 is the amount from fiscal year 2016. The numbers do fluctuate from year to year, and they don't fluctuate in such a large amount that we went back and took an average. We are definitely targeting our consultation efforts to try to reduce the overall number of violations and hopefully reduce penalties.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That helps.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. So my understanding is under federal law, the penalties have to be adjusted for inflation. They haven't been adjusted for inflation since 1990. That's the penalty change, and it's an inflation adjustment. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety, Representative Guerra, that's absolutely correct.
And I would just note, I also agree most businesses do the right thing. I have in the past represented one person who was killed because of something that was very unsafe at the workplace, and another who was almost killed because something was very unsafe at the workplace. So it happens sometimes, but I've got no other questions.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you. Just a couple things. Well, the first one is we're not pegging to a number anymore, right? So we won't have to come back. You're allowed to adjust based upon the Fed. So it's not like some of the other things we have to come back to every year, and if there's something we have to specifically add it through legislation. This allows you to just keep up with the Feds and stay there without having to do additional. I'm just wondering, is there a I know because we this comes up before, where we give an agency authority that is legislative authority. Is that an issue here?
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety. To answer the first part of your question, that's correct. We will be allowed to adjust according to changes in the federal penalty amounts. And in order to address the fact that we are being given regulatory authority here, we put in the bill that the department will be limited to the corresponding federal penalty amounts for each violation type. So we're not really being given authority to decide what penalty amount we want. We can't go above and beyond the corresponding federal penalty.
May I follow up?
Follow up?
So, changing the subject a little bit. So you said the penalty of, was it 596 was a pretty standard number. Have you looked at how many OSHA inspectors you have and how many penalties you've had, and if that's changed with the number of employees you've had doing this work? Has that changed that? I mean, you talk about being able to mitigate and do consultations and deal with that and bring it down to zero many times, but still, if you have, I know the department has had lost a lot of employees over the years, and general fund dollars have become tighter and tighter, but has that been an issue on some of the years? If you go back and you see where you had more public safety inspectors, does that show a change in that number?
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety. Representative Guttenberg, I would definitely have to go and get those numbers for you. We've had some small personnel changes over the years, but it's been relatively steady, so we could definitely go through and get that information if you want.
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you, Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said that you did many inspections, and you're sure somewhere it's documented how many inspections that you've done, but my question is the this 596 average, is it, and would you estimate that it's more an accumulation of small fees, so lots of small penalties, or is it more an accumulation of some larger ones, their fines or not fees?
Through the chair, Deb Kelly, Labor Standards and Safety. Representative Tilton, I would have to go back and look to answer that in any kind of exact sense, but I can say that there are a lot of small penalties assessed over the course of a year. We do roughly 400 enforcement inspections over the course of a year, and each one of those inspections may or may not result in a penalty, but when there is a penalty, it's generally a small one. The exception comes when we find a particularly egregious violator, such as the trench collapse that was in the news a couple years ago, where the young man was attempted to be dug out with heavy equipment that resulted in a substantial penalty.
Any further questions of the committee? Seeing no questions, we will open this up to public testimony for HB 121. And do we have anybody online who would like to testify? Nobody online. Anybody in the room who would like to testify on HB 121? Seeing nobody, just a reminder again that if folks would like to submit written testimony, that can be submitted to housefinance@akleg.gov. So with that, we will go ahead and close public testimony. And if the committee is comfortable with moving HB 121 and there are no objections, Representative Guerra, if you could please read the fiscal note into the record.
Mr. Chair, we have one fiscal note. It is OMB component 970. It shows that in the first half year, the first fiscal year, 2018, the penalties in addition that we'll receive are $217,500. And then in the next full years, it'll double that amount to $435,000 for a full year of collections. And that is the only fiscal note from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and the allocation is occupational safety and health.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
On that, and I'm not sure how these fiscal notes are, because this one had the same one. This is only if we find these penalties. So this is just an estimate. It really is an unknown amount, because hopefully we won't be writing a whole lot of citations because things are going well out in the business world. So although this looks like the general fund is going to have more money in it, I think it's a hope of everybody around the table that it doesn't grow for this way, because we don't want to penalize our businesses if we don't have to. Thank you.
Okay. With that, if the committee is okay with moving the bill out, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill number 121, that's 30LS0362/0. Or backslash O from committee with a single zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing no objections, HB 121 version O for Oscar is moved from committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the report.
Thank you, Mr. Coacher.
Okay, House Finance is back on record, and our last bill up this morning is HB 120, which is Department of Law Advocacy before FERC by the Governor. And here to present HB 120 is Ed Sniffen, attorney with the Department of Law. I see we also have Emma Polkin here. And so if you could both put yourselves on the record and begin with your PowerPoint presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ed Sniffen, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. I am the supervisor of the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section. And thank you, committee, for hearing our bill today. So HB 120 is a bill aimed at allowing the Department of Law the flexibility to spend money it receives from a regulatory cost charge, which I'll explain in a little bit, for matters that we are currently doing in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or the FERC. So as I'm sure you all know, all utilities and pipelines in Alaska are regulated. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska receives filings from pipelines and utility companies to adjust their rates frequently, and the Regulatory Commission is charged with making sure those rates are just and reasonable. To pay for that regulation, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has a regulatory cost charge that it imposes on all utilities. You might see it on your utility bills. It's that small line item at the very bottom that's 49 cents or some amount, And that goes to pay for the function of the Regulatory Commission to provide its administrative regulation of utilities. The Department of Law also gets a piece of that. We have a section, our Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section, that also appears before the Regulatory Commission in these matters to protect consumers. We are the face of the public. We are there to protect individual consumers' interest in their rates. And so when NSTAR or Chugach or Juneau Electric want to raise their rates, we go to the Public Utility Commission and say, not so fast, let's make sure those rates are just and reasonable. And so for our efforts, we also get to use money from the regulatory cost charge to pay for the services we do. Now, we have a short presentation here, a PowerPoint that walks through the regulatory cost charge that puts some context into how that fund is set and the limits on that fund. So, again, it's assessed on public utilities and pipelines. It's created by these two statutes, one for utilities and one for pipelines. Those charges that are assessed by the Regulatory Commission onto the utilities and pipelines are generally passed on to their customers, and those are the customers that receive the benefit of the regulation. And each year, the RCA assesses these RCCs to utilities and pipelines based on the amount of work required by each industry sector. What that means is if in a particular year we're spending a lot of time doing electric utility regulation, the electric utilities will pay a little more of that regulatory cost charge. And if the next year we do more in gas, the gas utilities might pay a little more of that cost charge. And again, this just pays for the work of the RCA and the Department of Law to perform these functions, to review and make sure those rates are just and reasonable. Here's the cap on that fund. So the legislature has set a cap on how big that fund can be, and that cap is a total of 0.87%, and that's split between the RCA and RAPA, the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section of the Department of Law, whereas the RCA cannot exceed 0.7% of the adjusted gross revenue of all the utilities and pipelines in Alaska, and the RAPA amount cannot exceed 0.17% of that amount. So there's a cap on how much money we can spend from this regulatory cost charge. And this is how it's been split up. And we use 2017 as an example. So our statutory cap in 2017 was $2.374 million. Our budget that we submitted to the RCA was actually $2.3 million, so we're $40,000 roughly under the cap. And of that, about 7% of that was used for work we did on pipelines, and 93% was used on work we did for the utilities. So what this this bill does, it doesn't grow that pie any. That pie is not going to change. But what we're asking the legislature to do is allow us to include within that pie matters that we are currently doing before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And we're asking to do that because over the last couple of years, we've tried to control our costs a little more, and we're bringing work that traditionally was done by outside counsel on these FERC matters in-house. And so we've reduced our outside counsel fees by very significant amounts, and we're trying to build that expertise in-house and do that work in-house. So because of that, we're spending more of our time on matters that come before the FERC for TAPS pipeline tariff work. And as we see that our work in that area is growing, we found an opportunity to amend the statute to allow us to recover from the RCC pot of money work that we are currently doing before the FERC. Right now, the way the statute is written, we can only recover from this fund for work that comes before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And so the way these cases generally work is, let's say the pipeline carriers file a tariff increase. They have to file it both with the FERC and with the RCA because there's an interstate and intrastate jurisdictional component to that. There's an interstate tariff that is set that pays for the cost of shipping oil outside of Alaska, and then there's an intrastate tariff that is also set for in-state shippers who take oil from the pipeline. So there are two proceedings filed, one at the RCA, one at FERC. But what the RCA would generally do is say, well, you've got this matter going on before FERC. We're going to just hold on to this matter for a while. let you go litigate this in front of FERC, and when you're done at FERC, you know, come back to us with you know, everything kind of nice and tidy, and then we'll adopt, you know, generally they will adopt whatever results happen in the FERC proceedings. So our FERC work directly benefits work that we would otherwise have to do before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. But instead, we're doing it all in front of FERC in Washington, D.C., and that's where our efforts are spent. And then the results of those efforts flow through to the RCA and to the intrastate shippers. So that's why we're asking for a change to allow us to include some of those costs that we do in front of FERC to be included within this mix. Again, it's not going to grow the pie any, but it might take that wedge that says pipelines, and it might make that wedge just a little bigger. So it would necessarily result in a decrease in the utility RCC, because the pie is only so big, so if you move it around, it's going to affect the utilities. But we think it will give us the flexibility to decide how we want to, you know, budget our work on an annual basis.
I got a question from Representative Prem.
Yes. Thank you. Would this help decrease outside council costs? Is that
Through the chair, Representative Gren, yes, that is one of our intents. Like, for example, we have paid our outside counsel FERC attorneys over the last, you know, 30 years, something like $90 million. So that's a lot of money, but it's, you know, it's returned a lot of results. You know, we've saved billions of dollars because of that. But you know, we're taking these multi-million-dollar annual contracts, and we're really scaling them back and doing that in-house, and this would allow us to pay for some of that work as well. For example, our outside counsel contract last year went from over $1 million to about $350,000. So we're really trying to economize where we can, and this would definitely help that. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've said a couple times that the pie is not getting any bigger. Now, the cap is based upon the statutory cap. So what happens if we had major pipeline work or something else going on here? There would be a little advance on all of that stuff, and would you come back and ask for an adjustment on that for a specific purpose? Would that be part of that?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that's exactly correct. I mean, the work's got to get done. This pie is only going to be able to pay for so much of it. If we have to do more, we would seek some general fund sources for that.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Guttenberg.
Okay, so I had another question, but you were talking about general fund sources you just mentioned. But wouldn't all the additional work be receipt supported services that you would be able to charge to somebody else, or would you just be doing the state's position in this case?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we do represent the state on matters before the FERC, because the results of our work there also affect the production taxes and royalties that the state pays. In the past, we've been using you know, one-time increment budgetary sources to pay for outside counsel to help us with that work. We're trying to scale back on that, but if something blew up and we had a big piece of litigation that we absolutely had to defend to save the state you know, revenue, we would probably ask for it in that one-time appropriation.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Thank you. So under all utilities, you're talking about all other utilities, sewer and water, power, telephone, everything else. That's that whole general sphere of things, right?
Yes, through the chair, President Guttenberg, that's correct.
Okay, so I'm gonna, kind of taking my own interest here, if I may, Mr. Chair. So, and I've been having discussions with the department about this for a while. So getting on to the issue of broadband, the RCA has had some positions that it's had with the FCC. And they tell me, and you guys tell me, that broadband work is not under the domain of the RCA, but they have done some things, and I'm just wondering if those would be under the category of incidental costs, not major costs. If it's just things that are not major cases that don't require a major amount of time, is that kind of a category of that world?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, yes, I think that's correct. I don't think that the broadband and telecom work is not with I wouldn't say it's not within the domain of the RCMP. I think there is jurisdiction there, and it overlaps a little bit. For what we do in RAPA, in the Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy section, we're focused more on the rate-making cases and advocating for consumers who have to pay a tariff. It's tariff work and rate-making stuff. And the telecom stuff is more licensing stuff and other things that I think the RCA does have some overlapping jurisdiction in. But for the section that I supervise, we don't really intersect with that very much occasionally. So I think you're absolutely correct. It's one of those sort of lesser things that kind of comes up that it doesn't really take a lot of our attention. And I'm not aware in the last couple of years anyway of any matter before the FCC that we've been involved with as part of RAPA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll show you the documents. Just one more question, Mr. Chair. So I am trying to find out who has jurisdiction over broadband rates, right? I'm told this between the FERC and RCA. It's those guys. Can you later at some point come out with me with the jurisdictional issues of who controls broadband rates, whether it's utility or not, public utility or not, and is it simply not regulated at all, or who looks after the public's interest in charges and things like that? So we can do that later, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to the last slide? It's not 100% instructive, but so I've got a concern about the bill, and I think maybe I'll have you discuss a little bit about the consumer function over at the RCA, which used to be at the Regulatory Commission. But first, I should probably say Ed and I first met each other. We were on opposite sides of a case, and I think it was one of the most collegial cases we ever had, and I think the state's lucky to have you working at the Attorney General's office. Let me summarize and tell me where I have this wrong if I get anything wrong. But under the Murkowski administration, the consumer function where you represented consumers on whether a rate increase was proper or not, that was within the RCA. And then there were complaints about that or whatever. And the result was that the consumer function where consumers' interests in fair utility rates was moved over to the Attorney General's office, and that's how the current section got created. Fair rendition of the history?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that's fair, yes.
Okay. There's always been a consumer function, and basically the consumer function is there because utilities are, they're sometimes monopolies, sometimes close to monopolies, and we have to have some sort of regulation to make sure the price increases get reviewed by somebody. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, Representative Guerra, yes.
So my concern now is, I think the move of the consumer function was fine to the Department of Law over time. I was skeptical at the time. But I do want the consumers to have a voice on rate setting. And if the pie doesn't grow, but we do more in-house work on Federal Energy Regulatory Commission sort of work. I know you're not overloaded with staff at the Attorney General's office these days, and I'm concerned that might, like you said, if we do more pipeline work, we might do less utility work. Help me with my concern that the public's voice on utility rate increases might be less represented if we did that.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, and a fair question. We have added staff to the RAPA section to deal with our pipeline matters, and that position is largely paid out of our budget from law. And because we're going to grow this pipeline experience and maybe tap into some more of this RCC, like you say, with the cap not growing, it can grow a little bit. I don't see that as affecting our ability to effectively represent consumers zealously as we always have been. Currently, we don't really know what's going to happen from year to year. Who's going to file a rate case? Who's not going to file a rate case? Right now, we're doing a couple of big ones involving MLMP, involving NSTAR. It's taking a lot of our time, and we're doing a little bit of pipeline work, but it's slowed down. So we are directing our energies to those utility cases. In other years, we might have more pipeline work and just have less utility work because we don't control when they file their tariff filings. We respond to them when they come in, and when they do come in, we always respond when the commission asks us to. So what this bill would do, though, is give us the flexibility in perhaps those years where we don't have as many utility cases going on and we have more pipeline work going on, we can adjust our revenue sources a little bit to compensate us for work we're doing in both of those sectors a little more evenly. If we had a year, for example, now, where we might not have a lot of utility filings and we just don't spend a lot of our budget, that money would just lapse. And in that same year, say we had a lot of pipeline work that we were doing and benefiting the in-state pipeline shippers, we wouldn't be able to recover any of that lapsed money because we don't have the authority to do that.
Through the chair. So I think I understand. You'll be doing the same amount of work. It'll give you more flexibility to access the fees that come in. But if in one year, I mean, right now you're using general fund to spend to pay for some of the pipeline work. This will give you the flexibility, I guess, to, if you have a lower utility cost consumer protection year but a higher pipeline cost year, it'll give you the flexibility to access the funds. But in the end, you'll be doing the same amount of work, and if you have a lot of pipeline work and you don't therefore have enough money going to the utility function, then the general fund, the excess will just be paid for a general fund there. It would be roughly the same amount of money, but sometimes it'll, the GF will go to the utility attorneys and sometimes the GF will go to the pipeline attorneys. Is that a fair way to understand it?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, sort of. I think what would happen is we will always be doing our utility work, and that's the function that our statute contemplates we would do, and anything we do before the RCA we'll be able to bill to this RCC, and if we run out of RCC money and we have utility work to do, we still got to do it, and we'll probably ask for, you know, supplementation if that happens. We haven't had that, you know, yet. The fund's been adequate to cover all of our needs. But in a year where we might have more pipeline work and we do have a full plate of utility work as well, we would have to, the work's going to get done one way or the other. It's just who's going to pay for that work, and we would probably have to go outside and seek additional funding, you know, for that.
Okay, I almost understand, so okay. I'll let you go on and see if other people have questions.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. So can you tell me a recent time in which the Consumer Protection Division and the RCA disagreed on a particular situation or case?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. I can't off the top of my head, but I'll give that some more thought and see if I can get you an answer to that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then follow up, Mr. Chairman. In a case RCA members are appointed by the governor, they're approved by this legislature, and folks within the department are generally career folks. I guess I just have a question about what happens when the Department of Law disagrees with the rulings of the RCA. And I'm just wondering what happens in that sort of jeopardy case when you're fighting against basically yourselves in that case.
No, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think I understand your question better. We do have another section within the Department of Law. It's our consumer protection unit that's different from what we do. But we disagree with the Regulatory Commission frequently. on a variety of matters, we advocate before the commission on certain costs that should be or should not be included in rates, things like bonuses for utility representatives and stuff. And we'll argue no, and then the commission will rule, we're going to allow them. It becomes commission precedent, and then we'll decide if that's something worth appealing or not appealing. We have appealed recently a matter that the RCA ruled against us on. It was involving rate case expense. One of the odd things about this whole process is the utilities get to roll into their costs all of their litigation fees and all the money they spend to bring a case on any issue. It just doesn't matter what it is. They don't have really any incentive to not litigate, you know, aggressively on every issue, because all those costs get rolled into rates and they recover that amount. And we stood up against that in a pipeline case actually recently and said, you know, no, that that seems odd, especially in a case where there's been a finding of imprudence, for example, or something. And that's currently on appeal in the Alaska Superior Court. So there have been these tensions between us. We do try to act like independently on behalf of the public interest. And yeah, sometimes we do cross swords with the commissioners on certain issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Sniffen, I want to bring up the PetroStar case and ask you about the Quality Bank issue. And they didn't win, but they got another hearing in the courts over the justification for the formula, I guess is the best term for it. And the courts ruled that the state didn't have standing. And that's a concern for me, because the state represents the citizens, and it could be quite a bit of money as far as the rate paying go. I mean, I think PetroStar pays $25 million a year, something like that, into the Quality Bank. Not that that would all change, but a significant change would reflect to the consumers. And that was a concern for me, the whole case. That was kind of one of the things that stood out. Was there a difference between the state's position and representing the public on that, as far as what mattered to the public, as far as the outcome of that case?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I'm not as familiar with that case as I probably should be. I think your understanding is my understanding as well. Whether there's something different there, you know, that the way the Quality Bank works, and whether that impacts, you know, the state to the extent that we should have standing to participate in that case, versus whether or not we are arguing for transportation costs on the pipeline. I think they are different, but I'd be happy to have a discussion with you about that, and we can come up with that answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I think it's very appropriate that the state builds the expertise in house.
Representative Grant, did you have a question? No. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think we've covered just about everything on the rest of this presentation. But wanted to just get through these last couple slides. You know, what this bill will not do, as we mentioned, it's not going to increase the cap. What it will do is allow us to have some flexibility to arrange our caseload depending on the cases we get in a particular year. How this would impact consumers. We put this slide in here based on some questions in the House Judiciary Committee about how this would impact the pipeline shippers who would actually pay ultimately for this increased pipeline charge. And it really is a small amount in the greater scheme of things for the shippers. And the example we have here is if we added $100,000 to that piece of the pie for the pipelines, just based on information we have for the last two quarters of 2016, that would increase the surcharge by 0.041%. Or, for example, on a $10,000 billing, there would be an additional $4.10 to the shipper. So it's really not a big amount. And again, now I think we explained why we're doing it now is we're trying to save money by bringing this FERC work in-house, and as a result of doing that, we've tried to find a way to save the state a little money, and this is one of the ways we found to do that. And we've had some questions about whether this was something that would impact AKLNG, and the answer is no. Completely different jurisdictional issues there, and this is not anything that has to do with AKLNG. It would not impact that at all. And then lastly, I wanted to just let the committee know there's a check on our spending. Of course, the cap is the first one. We can't grow that without the legislature's permission. But the second one is every year we have to submit our budget to the regulatory commission, and that's done in a public docket. Everyone can comment on it, and they have to review and submit that. So We live in a fishbowl when it comes to our budget. It's out there for everyone to see, and you know, the public is certainly available and entitled to make comments on that if there's, you know, something inappropriate that they think we're doing. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee has, and thank you very much.
Are there any further questions of the committee? Representative Garrett.
Thanks. Mr. Stephan, you raised a question which concerns me a little bit, and that is that I guess I could see if you had a rate-setting case and a utility challenged it and they were right, that I guess I could see the argument, I guess. I don't know that I agree with it. I guess I could see them maybe passing that off to the consumers and their rates, but I can't really see why, if a utility challenged a rate setting and they lost, that they should still be able to send those fees over and make consumers pay for a challenge that they were wrong on. So do you make that distinction in your litigation? And I guess sitting here right now, I don't want to make your bill heavier, but I'm concerned about that.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, you and I are of the same mind, and the courts are not, but I know exactly what you're saying. That is a frustration of ours, and the precedent seems to be that if it's a legitimate, you know, reasonable challenge, regardless of whether there's a win or loss, those costs get to be recovered by the utility.
Through the chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. I mean, it seems the impact of this right now would be maybe whether you could use that excess $40,000, but I'm now most concerned about the issue you raised and whether or not we should address that while we have this before us. I know the governor probably doesn't have a position, so you're probably not allowed to have a position, but I think you've stated your view on whether what you think is fair and what you don't, and I think I agree with that. So I'll just leave it for that for right now.
Through the chair, Representative Gale, yeah, thank you, and be happy to discuss, you know, that with you on perhaps some other legislation.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I want to confirm something along the same line of thought. When the boroughs sue the state over the and the industry over the TAPS valuation issue, the costs that the boroughs incur go back to their citizens, and the costs that the Alyeska incurs goes into the rate making of the state's royalty and severance and all those things. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So the cost of Alyeska pipeline, for example, what the cost they incur to operate the pipeline and all of those things, is that what you're asking about?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Alyeska's the state does an evaluation of the pipeline, right? And every year it goes to court and it's litigated. When the borough is involved in a litigation, the citizens pay for it. When Alyeska does, it's part of their operational costs, and that comes off the wellhead costs and all those things down the line. So they pass that along back to the state. Is that an accurate assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, thanks for that clarification. So the cost that Alyeska gets to include in their rates is set by a bunch of rate-making principles. And so the cost to defend, for example, the value of the pipeline against like a tax increase or property tax valuation sort of proceeding. Generally, I hate to speculate on that. The real answer is I'm not sure. But I believe it may be something they do get to include in their costs.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And if you get back with us, can you separate whether they win or lose? Thank you.
I will. Thank you.
We have Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we talked the other day, and it brought up problem that I have anticipated in the RCA, and that is with, especially with co-ops, and there seems to be very high executive compensation in some of the co-ops, and although there is a board, the board is lay people that are there and are heavily influenced by the executives, and it seems that we have a potential situation where we have pretty small co-ops that have disproportionate executive compensation and bonuses and all those things, and I'm trying to figure out if there's a potential to be able to go in and set the maximum amount of executive compensation at the governor's salary plus, you know, his retirement bonuses or whatever those would be, or some mechanism to tie it to some other manager in Alaska, because most of these executives are really managing people. They're not necessarily electricians or designers or engineers or whatever. And, you know, I've received a lot of complaints from people in co-ops that, you know, they really don't have any method of controlling that. And so can you explain whether that would be in the purview, or is there any way we can address that kind of executive compensation limitation?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, thank you. And executive compensation is something we struggle with as well, while when we review the rate cases from the co-ops. And the current standard is, you know, whether or not the compensation is, you know, is just and reasonable, is it fair. The way that we might be able to, and we do scrutinize those things to make sure that, you know, someone isn't, you know, overcompensated, that inflates, you know, rates to the point that it just becomes unjust or unreasonable. A way to maybe get at limiting that might be through commission regulations, for example, and there may be, you know, some other, you know, statutory fixes for that. I'd have to think about that. But I share your concern. I know we had this discussion a little while ago, and we'll be happy to work on that, you know, with you if you'd like to pursue that any further.
Follow up?
And another idea that's come forward is to give the board some impetus to make sure that they are addressing that is if you have co-ops that are tax exempt, if they pay executive compensation above a certain level, they would no longer be tax exempt. Would that be something that would be in the control of the board to make sure that they didn't exceed those just and reasonable limits? But is that something that has been considered at all?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we haven't considered that, but I think it's creative. I'm not a tax expert on this, and we can explore that and see if that might be, you know, some way to incentivize, you know, like these smaller co-ops to make sure that their executive compensation is fair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And if you could get back to the
yes.
committee on any that or any other ideas, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. With that, are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, we will go ahead and open up HB 120 to public testimony. And just a reminder that written testimony can be submitted to housefinance@akleg.gov. And with that, do we have anybody online? I don't believe we have anybody online. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And I believe that Representative Guerra was wanting to maybe hopefully bring this back this afternoon. I have to check our schedule really quick here. Let me just take a quick brief at ease here.
trust them.
Sounds ready.
All right. I like the song no matter what, bro.
Okay, House Finance is back on record. So let's see, with this, I think that there are some folks who would like to move it and some folks who would like to understand a little bit more. I think, we still have to bring this to the floor, and so there's some time to understand it. I think we're towards the end of session here, and I know that there's some discussion as to whether or not we go longer or not, but we don't know at this point, so let's be safe. And I know that this is something that the administration would like to see, so I think folks can continue to talk to Mr. Sniffen here. So with that, Representative Gehr, if you could please read the fiscal note into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only fiscal note that we have right now is OMB component 2764, and that's for the Department of Law, Civil Division, Regulatory Affairs, Public Advocacy, and the fiscal note is a zero fiscal note for the reasons Mr. Sniffen stated. There will not apparently be any extra cost to the Department of Law.
Any questions on the fiscal note or the bill? Representative, seeing no questions. Representative Guerra, if we could have a motion to move the bill from committee, if that is the will of the committee.
Yeah.
Representative Wilson.
You know, we were told at the beginning of finance that we were going to hear a bill and pass it out. We only got this bill last night, not just this bill, but the other two that we've already passed out. Maybe this is a no-brainer. I'm not that familiar with the RCC, the RAPA, the RCA portion of it. I mean, if you want to have a motion to move it out, I will object, and I will object not because it's not necessarily a good bill, it's because I've tried to do my due diligence on it. There's not a lot in our packet really explaining what this does, and I owe my constituents to know what a bill does before I vote for it. But I was assured earlier on when we started finance that we wouldn't be doing this, but it's your call, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And I understand the concern, and we're just trying to weigh, I guess, all the issues here. And so we hope that Mr. Sniffen will reach out to folks who may have some issues with this. And in the interest of time, and I think we'll go ahead and put it to a vote. And if the committee is as a whole is not comfortable with it, then it'll be voted down, and we'll have to revisit this. So with that, the objection is maintained, and if we could have a...
we haven't had a motion
yet.
Correct, yes. So is there a motion for the committee?
There will be when I find the actual bill.
And Mr. Chair, just real quick before you, and I'm not to stop that up, but just to the point, I mean, in this case, I understand a little bit of the bill, and I'd probably support the bill. I'm going to be supporting my member here with her concerns, with making sure that she has the opportunity to have some of the questions answered. And I realize we're at a tight schedule, and I don't put any fault on the chairs or anyone on that. It's just this is kind of the reality of being at the end of session. But I do think that if there are some questions that, just that opportunity, a member should be probably given that opportunity for it. So I'll be joining her in the opposition to moving it, but that doesn't mean it's opposition to the bill.
Mr. Thank Chair. You, Representative Pruitt. Representative Guerra?
Yeah, before I move the bill, I've spoken to Mr. Sniffen. I think he's been very open and said that he will have time to spend with members if they don't understand the bill. I understand the concerns, but I do think that we should move the bill out. So I will move HB 120 version 30 / GH 1875 / A with its fiscal note. I'll make a motion to move that out of committee.
Object.
And we have an objection.
And can I speak to my objection briefly?
Sure, Representative Wilson.
First of all, this bill is sitting over in the Senate Judiciary, still has to go through finance, so there isn't a rush. But I just want to put on record, now that I know what the new rules are and things are going to come to us and be passed out at the same time, I will do things differently. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, if we could have a roll call.
Representative Wilson? No. Representative Wilson? No. Representative Garrett? Yes. Representative Brent? Yes. Representative Gatenberg? Yes. Representative Kawasaki? Yes. Representative Pruitt? No. Representative Thompson? Yes. Representative Seaton? Yes. Representative Foster? Yes. 7 yeas, 3 nays.
And on a vote of 7 yeas to 3 nays, HB 120 version A for Alpha is adopted. And with that, if folks could please stay to sign the committee report. And our next meeting is scheduled for this afternoon, Thursday, April 6th at 1:30 p.m. And at this meeting, we'll be hearing HB 47, which is municipal PERS contributions and interest, HB 131, which is relocation assistance for federal projects and programs, and HB 141, which is the Alaska Workforce Investment Boards. And so with that, we will be adjourned at 10:23 a.m., and thank you.